Welcome once again to Book Spectrum. I'm Chris Cordani, your host. Some of the Democrats in the 2020 presidential primary vying to run against Donald Trump have brought forth some rather, shall we say, interesting economic plans to the debate stage. I'm not trying to be adversarial right now or anything like that. We would like to have an open discussion. We can argue over whether they're fantasy or feasible, but this is not what our guest on this edition of Book Spectrum is here to discuss. His book is titled Capitalism for Democrats, Why the Country Needs It Now. It's an economic handbook we probably all wish they would read, but it's something that could put more people in tune with those who are in the center of the Nolan Square, according to the author, economist Martin Lowy. Welcome to Book Spectrum, Martin.
Thank you, Chris. Nice to be here.
Well, it's very nice to have you here, but first, please tell the listeners a bit about you and your background in economics.
I don't have a degree in economics. My degrees are in history and law. But I like to say I learned economics at the dinner table. Back in the 1970s and early 80s, I had a client who had been the dean of a business school at Long Island University and a professor at Columbia in economics. And he had a round table dinner once a month with some of the leading economists in the New York area. And he used to invite me as a regular member of his roundtable. And so once a month, I sat there and listened to the best economists in New York, and I had a right to ask questions as well as discuss. And after 3 years of that, I had a pretty good education.
Martin, let's talk about this because you studied history and African politics, then law, practiced that for many years, and were a senior bank officer and entrepreneur. How have the diverse areas of study and occupation shaped your view on how the U.S. economy should work?
Oh, I guess gradually in many ways. In college, I was extremely liberal, thought maybe for a while that I was a socialist. went to law school to study international law and found that there really wasn't much law in international law. And ended up going to work for a Wall Street firm and practicing corporate law, which I liked. But after 20 years, I found that I had, and partnerships in two big firms, I found that I had done everything that I really wanted to do in the law. And so on my 20th anniversary of the practice, going into practice, I decided to do something else, and that something else was to become vice chairman of a bank, which I did for 3 years. And then at the end of 3 years, my chairman and I had a parting of the ways.
That's a nice way to put it. There we go. A parting of the ways.
Yeah, we had a parting of the ways, and I took a little vacation, and I got up at 2 o'clock in the morning, woke my wife and said, I'm going out on the beach. It was a beach vacation. And I just didn't want her to wake up and find me not there, right?
That makes sense.
So I went out and I walked the beach from 2 to 6, watched the sunrise, came back and announced to my wife, I'm going to write a book. There are SNLs failing all over the United States, and I'm going to write a book about it. And so I wrote my first book called High Rollers, Inside the Savings and Loan Debacle, which was cited by the Supreme Court of the United States and continues to be, I hope, the leading book on its subject. And I will be writing, that was 30 years ago, and I will be writing a new version that will be real history. But anyway, so I wrote High Rollers and then looked around and said, I better go earn a living. And what I really wanted to do was I wanted to be CEO of a substantial bank, but there was no substantial bank that wanted me as CEO.
I have the same problem, by the way. That's my issue, too. That's why I went into this.
there were small banks that wanted me as CEO, but that really didn't interest me. So I tentatively went back to the practice of law. And I had left for the right reasons. Ended up having a crazy idea to do sports simulation and with real balls and real pucks and all that, and started that adventure in 1992 or
three. A while after that. You embarked on an interesting entrepreneurial career. We might want to talk about that in a little bit. It'll sort of contribute to why you have the book and why you wrote the several other books you've put out. The title of this one, though, Capitalism for Democrats, might sound a bit snarky, but it really isn't when one opens up the book and reads it. The tone is rational. Those looking for partisan pot shots might be a little disappointed at first, but perhaps wiser to our system and its merits when read further. Why'd you choose the title Capitalism for Democrats? Because it is kind of a sensational title.
Yeah, I chose it because in this year, we have the Democratic primaries coming up, and we have issues that we haven't had to deal with for a very long time in terms of the diversity of the kinds of candidates that we have. Some at least one project who says he's a socialist, and others who say that they're centrists, and others in between. And so I thought this really ought to be directed to Democrats. Now, I should say, Chris, that the feedback that I've got, the reviews that I've got, have said this really is not just for Democrats. It's for all Americans. And so I am working on another volume, a companion volume, that will be Capitalism for America, and do away with the snarky title.
Having said that, though, it is important that the title is Capitalism for Democrats, because the perception now is, and look, if you listen to MSNBC or even watch part of CNN and definitely hear what's going on with the Democratic debate, you can think that a very far left socialist wing of the party is starting to take it over, and socialism has become more popular, if you will. I think that's the proper word for it among younger people for one reason or another.
Yes, and I think they're not sure what socialism means.
Exactly. We don't educate our students. We don't educate young people on what it really means and the failed socialist governance of the years that maybe we heard about in our younger years.
I think that's true, although I don't know exactly what gets taught in high schools these days or in colleges. I'm a long way away from that. But I do have the sense that the academy has been seized largely by the left. I don't think that that's a really good thing. I think that, you know, not to say things were better in my day, but we had a diversity of professors when I was in college. We had some who were socialists and some who were very much right wing. I have always embraced that kind of diversity.
These are long past the days of Eugene V. Debs running for president four times and being having a small following because socialism was more of an untried form of government. We see the failures of that particular form. And we also see that the richest countries in the world, most of them, because we're not talking currency manipulation and other things, happen to be capitalist societies, or at least some form of capitalism, whether it be full free market or something in the middle like us, or maybe developing nations working on that as well. I mean, the pattern's there.
Yes. And you know, when you ask the young people who think they're socialists, you ask them, well, what socialist country do you want to emulate? And what you hear mostly is Sweden.
Right. That's not really a socialist nation.
No, it is not. And I do cover that in the book, that it's not really a socialist nation. It happens to have some unique ways of governing itself, but they're not socialist. And it also is, in a sense, not a good example for America because the population of Sweden is about the population of metropolitan New York.
Exactly.
The population is quite homogeneous, other than some recent immigrants. It's a homogeneous population that goes back a long way. And so they tend to have less disagreement on their goals than we do in the U.S.
Another thing I want to throw out there, and I want to delve into your book a little bit, but for background, People look at a book or commentator that says what they're thinking. They like to read something that says, hey, I want to validate my own thoughts. It's like my party good, your party bad. But your book is for people who are sick of, and this is a growing faction, people who are tired of hearing left-right tribalism politics.
And I am tired of it too.
Well, we all are.
I really am.
But then the economic system gets thrown in the middle. We hear about the politics. People like to say, there ought to be a law. This has to be done. Somebody's got to do something about this when they don't like something. But when it comes to our economic system, that kind of gets thrown in. So it's almost like purveyors of free market capitalism. I mean, full untouched free market laissez-faire capitalism on one end are saying, well, we'll trade this for this if you agree with us here. And people on the far left looking for socialism saying, well, we'll trade socialist policies for your more sensitive social policies and just back us so we'll back you. And all of a sudden we become a tribal nation and nobody understands, hey, wait a minute here. Our system actually works. We can make it work a little better, but nobody's talking about that.
That's right. I think that if we look at the pattern of voters on a national basis over the last 20 years or so, everybody wants change.
It's a nice word.
The winners have bashed the status quo and asked for change, regardless of whether it was change for the left or the change for the right. And in the event, Barack Obama turned out to be a centrist. I mean, I do understand that many Republicans called him a socialist, but in fact, he was quite a centrist. And I might have hoped that he could be someone who brought the country together. In the event that didn't work, why that didn't work.
Right. That's not what we're here for. We're here to talk about how the economy works and why your book is actually something that maybe people on both sides should really read. Again, my side good, your side bad is really wearing thin on most of the public. This is what happened in 2018's election and 2016's election. We can talk about that all we want. But the fact is, you also say, hey, wait a minute here. While we shouldn't have socialism, our particular brand of capitalism is good for a lot of reasons, but there are some things we can work out. You dedicate a lot of time to your thoughts on good capitalism versus bad capitalism in the book. Let's hit there.
Sure. We need to understand capitalism works only when we also have a decent safety net. And in the U.S., we have a safety net that isn't quite adequate. Now, when we design safety net policies, we do have to be aware that if we go too extreme, we can rob people of incentives to work and incentives to make the economy work. And so that's an issue. And when we enact regulations, we have to understand that sometimes we can enact regulations that actually do more harm than good. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't have regulations. It doesn't mean we shouldn't have more safety net. One of the things that we have not been good at in our safety net is in helping out people who have lost their jobs due to either foreign competition or technology. And one can't know in many cases, you know, why one's job disappeared. It could be foreign competition. It could be technology. It could be a combination of factors. But we need to help those people more than we have been. That's one of the things that I think is important. We have shown that universal health care is something that people want and that can work. Question is, how should you do it? There are all kinds of ideas. My perspective is, let's do it one way or another because it's needed. Whether it should be a Medicare kind of program or a private program, I'm really not sure. But we can all discuss it rationally if we agree that we need a program that works for everybody.
Martin Lowy is our guest on this edition of Book Spectrum. His book, Capitalism for Democrats. Yes, the title sounds funny and cute, and but the fact is, it's a pro-American book. I want to talk about the safety net you discussed, because a truly capitalist system does unfortunately have to have unemployment, which we don't want, but 100% employment is not very easy to do, and that also results in underemployment. A good capitalist system needs to find a way to put that safety net in for people who have lost their jobs, but also try to find a way to retrain people who want to try something different, who aren't working at the time, and take care of some of the families, many of which have contributed to the economy previously before losing their work.
Yes, and one of the issues is how do you take care of them? And one of the things that I think works well is let me back up and say, I'm a believer that people feel best when they have a job. They'd like to contribute. I don't think most people want to, you know, sit on the sidelines and collect money for nothing. They really do want a job, and I believe that people feel better when they're working. So you want people to go back to work. There's an impediment often to going back to work because the jobs that they're offered are lower paying jobs than the jobs that they had.
Exactly. That's underemployment.
Well, we have a program where we do make up some of that difference between what they were making and what they are making now. But that program is very limited, and it requires a showing that it was due to foreign competition. We should expand that program and just say, for whatever reason, you lost your job. You take a job. We want you to take another job. If you take a job that has lower pay, we're going to make up for a certain period of time a certain percentage of that difference. That is, the government is going to make it up. So that encourages you to take a job. You're no longer on the dole, and you're able to have self-respect, take care of your family, whether you're a man or a woman, single or married, doesn't matter. You're able to have self-respect and take care of your family and yourself. The expense is a relatively small expense compared to the good that we can do with it.
Well, it's not just good. It also brings people back to work. There is an incentive in our system also not to work. That's another issue altogether. But the book here, your book, Capitalism for Democrats, brings across something that I believe should be said by many people who've turned closed-minded over the years. Let's sit down and have a conversation. You, Martin, represent in the book, Capitalism for Democrats, a moral argument for capitalism. And we do hear, capitalism is immoral. You hear a lot of kids on college campuses screaming that. It's immoral. Capitalism can leave. We want, and they have the communist symbols are on the signs. You have the International Socialist Organization in there helping kids promote. We talked about this a little bit earlier. Before I go off on that tangent, let's talk about your moral argument for capitalism.
The reason why capitalism is moral is because it really is based on decisions being made by consumers and not by elites. That is, when the world, the business world, decides, what is it going to produce? It's going to produce what people will buy, and it will produce it only if it's at a price that people will buy. There are millions of customers making billions of decisions who are determining what gets built, what gets sold, and at what price. Now, it also has to be practical from the point of view of making it, but it is the consumers and not an elite that's chosen somehow that makes those decisions. And I think that that is the moral basis of capitalism. And when we lose sight of that, and when we let elites make the decisions instead of the marketplace, then I think we get away from that moral basis of capitalism. And that, to me, is problematic.
It's true, and it sounds like a lot of young people, and I'm not saying all of them, but a lot of them say, wait a minute, I wouldn't mind somebody telling me what to do or buy or where to work because, and we have to add this in, this economy has been a little rough on them coming out of college. They were tricked into expensive college degrees that might not be worth anything after they get out. They don't have the same real money environment that maybe somebody 40, 50, or even 30 years ago may have had when it came to buying a house or buying a car. Let's face that as a fact. Sometimes turning away from capitalism is a sign of desperation. There are factions that are taking advantage of it, but how can we help educate young people? And believe me, reading your book, Capitalism for Democrats, will be a big help. But how can we, everyday people, just say, hey, this is a good system. We'll show you why.
Yes, there are no magic words.
A magic wand.
And, yeah, we would like one of those, wouldn't we? But there are no magic words when we talk with younger people who have questions, because their experience, as you said, particularly those who were sort of coming of age when the Great Recession hit in 2008, that was a terrible jolt to them, in part because they were told that that could not happen. They were growing, they grew up believing that that kind of thing couldn't happen. The Great Depression was a long time ago. It wasn't going to happen again. Well, it almost happened. And so their faith in the system was really shaken. And, you know, one has to not only understand that, but sympathize with it. And one of the things I don't talk about much in this book, but I have talked about in other books, is that in the 1990s, there were top economists who were saying that we don't have to worry about boom and bust because the Fed can always clean up and prevent a bust from getting too far.
Yes, in theory, yeah, in theory they can do that, but again, it's a paper tiger. We saw three quantitative easings from 2009 onward. It temporarily triggered a sort of a jumpstart to the economy each time, but the fact is, when the easing is over, and you saw some of that effect in December of 2018, as a matter of fact, it could do some damage to the markets overall, and it's not a real boost to any economy. It's sort of Potemkin Village, if you will.
You know, Chris, I'm not a macroeconomist, but I think we know a lot less about how to deal with those issues than we think. And when I say we, I mean the world at large. As I think I say in the book, the Fed does not admit to its shortcomings. The Congress thinks the Fed has to be wizards. But the fact is that the Fed are not wizards. They're just human beings who have usually economics degrees, but maybe the current chairman doesn't. And they are trying to figure out what's going on just as much as the rest of us. So I don't think that they have any magic. And did quantitative easing work? Did it not work? Even in hindsight now? I don't know. I mean, I read a lot of this stuff, but I really don't know whether it was the right thing or the wrong thing. I tend to think that probably it was as much right as wrong, but I cannot tell.
The book Capitalism for Democrats is a very pro-America book. It's not a your party good, my party bad, like we just talked about before. It's not my system great, your system is demonic. But it is saying our system works pretty well, and there are a lot of reasons for that. But a lot of that is also our own due diligence. So let's talk consumer awareness, which is something you bring up in the book. And I believe we should talk about that, especially in the context of this conversation. And for the listeners, you campaigned for the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau in the past. Do you think consumers are well-informed today? And if not, what can we do to remedy that?
Well, I think that consumers are never going to be fully informed because they don't have the time. It's largely their responsibility to utilize the tools that are available. And what government and regulation have to do is to make the tools available. And that means things like the Consumer Finance Bureau, Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, and the FTC and other agencies. There also is a responsibility on the part of sellers to try to make their products useful for consumers. What I see is that the most successful companies are the ones who do that and who don't deceive the consumers.
You're right, Martin, because word spreads a lot more quickly these days.
Yes, it does. And that's one of the wonderful things about the internet. If a company is doing bad things, people find out about it pretty quickly. And companies that have respect in the marketplace, like Apple can charge more for its phones because people like them.
Well, I want to interject here, though, Martin, because you remember when they started slowing down some of the older phones, internet reception to force them to buy the newer phones, that did come out. And they had to get out in front of that real quick. So that's important, too. The consumer wised
up. That's right.
That's right. And consumers will
that's
go
right.
to the other guy if they feel their company isn't doing well. So you got to get out in front. This capitalist system technically forces companies to do the best they can for their consumers because they'll just say, hey, wait a minute here. We're not loyal to you if you're not loyal to us. We're going to the other guy.
That's what it's meant to do. But, you know, one of the things that we don't do well is to teach young people about how to be good consumers. It depends upon one's parents. If your parents are good consumers, chances are you will be. And if your parents are not good consumers, chances are you won't be either. But our schools don't do a good job of teaching people how important it is to be a good consumer, not only for themselves, but for the system.
And that's very important too, Martin. When I was growing up in the 1970s, we used to have, along with the cartoons, little consumer tips, PSAs that kids could watch and learn from. We did have some time taken out by our elementary school teachers to say, hey, learn how to spend your money wisely. You may only get a few dollars, or if you wind up getting a paper route later on, understand how this works. That should be taught more in the schools today as well.
Certainly, schools ought to teach about being a consumer, and I don't think that... I don't think that's thought about much in educational circles because they're so preoccupied now with the testing, which is, you know, basic reading and math, that other subjects and other thoughts tend to get pushed aside.
Keep in mind, financial literacy is very important these days, and that's not taught. That really hasn't been taught over the years. I'm not sure if that's by design or not, but it's something that districts should be looking into.
It is not by design. It is, however, I think a product of the type of people who go into teaching. They tend not to be interested in finance very much. I don't mean that critically of them. That's just who they are.
That makes a lot of sense.
And I recall vividly that when I came out with my first book, High Rollers, I made what turned out to have been a tactical mistake, and that is that I discussed the most important things about what had happened to the SNLs right up front, which is accounting.
And I
explained what had happened because of the bad accounting right up front. Well, what I discovered was teachers were turned off by that. They didn't want to read the book.
Interesting, but it's something we should be looking at anyway.
Accounting is not an interesting subject to many people, including, it appears, teachers.
That's where I want to ask this question. What do you want the readers to get most from this book, Capitalism for Democrats? And I mean all sides, not just the Democrats in the title.
I want people to come away with the feeling that capitalism works, we should keep it, we need to improve it, but we should improve it by having... By understanding that all kinds of people have interesting and possibly useful ideas, and that we should learn to talk to each other to sort out which of those ideas should be used in trying to improve it.
We should all sit at the table, have a discussion, and stop shutting the other side out, because there are some good ideas all around the Nolan Square. Let's talk about perspectives before we go now. I wanted to add this in, and this is the perfect place for it. In 1964, you got to learn some interesting perspectives from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. You got to spend some time with him alone.
Yes. I had 1 hour alone with Dr. King, and it was a fabulous hour. What did I learn? I didn't learn anything concrete. Mostly he was asking questions, not giving answers. But I learned that, first of all, a great man can be inquisitive and really not want to talk about himself, wanted to learn more about, in this case, Yale University, which is where we were. And second, a person can be quiet and yet have tremendous charisma, and that's what he had. He was soft-spoken and polite, but there was it just radiated from him, this charisma. And one can't replicate it, but one can, by respecting it, hopefully carry oneself better through life than not having had that experience.
Martin Lowy, how can our listeners learn more about you and Capitalism for Democrats?
Go to capitalismfordemocrats.com, and it's all there. I'd like for you to go and see it. And if you want to buy the book, you can do it through the link there, or you can go to Amazon and put in Capitalism for Democrats, and it will come up.
Thank you for coming on with us, Martin.
Thank you.
Once again, the book is Capitalism for Democrats, Why the Country Needs It Now by Martin Lowy. You can also find out more and links to Martin's site and book on our website, bookspectrum.com. I'm Chris Cordani. Thank you for listening to Book Spectrum.